It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The State Department of Natural Resources calls the muskie the most sought-after trophy fish in Wisconsin. And it's implicated in fish stories as the one that got away.
As anglers head out on lakes and rivers in pursuit of Wisconsin state fish, we learn how this season could shape up. We've reeled in Brett Alexander, a sport fishing guide based in Green Bay. Brett, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. How are you doing today?
Doing well. So over the weekend, the state DNR opens muskie season for anglers across much of northern Wisconsin. And how was your first weekend? Give us an assessment.
Well, the weekend was good. We had a lot of rain this weekend, but the fishing was pretty decent. Right now, I had a schedule probably about three weeks ahead with where the muskies normally are. So normally they're in all the tributary rivers and they're still doing their spawning and they're pretty easy to target. Well, because of the warm temperatures and the mild winter and everything, our temperatures are quite a bit higher in the system here on Green Bay. So the fish are actually going into their early summer patterns already. So they're quite a bit ahead of schedule.
So that meant more activity for you this weekend?
Well, the bite was pretty decent, but typically muskie fishing on Green Bay, like that mid to late June, is one of the tougher periods because the fish go out really deep and they'll feed on large bait balls. And once the weeds start growing, then they'll push into the weeds. So we got about 2 weeks where these fish are going to be in deep water. They're going to be harder to target. And in about 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, once the weeds start to get some growth to them, then they'll push into the weeds and it's a lot easier to find them and target them.
So when they're in this deep water, this is like a pretty tough fish. They're strong. What kind of line are you using?
We run pretty heavy line. We run 100-pound test super line, and then we run some fluorocarbon leaders, 150-pound fluorocarbon leaders. So we're pretty prepared for them.
And what about the bait?
We use a lot of different baits. So this time of the year, we're mostly throwing what everybody calls like a bucktail. So it's basically a wire lure with two blades on it. It makes a lot of vibration, a lot of noise, so the muskies can key in on that.
Would that be used when they get into the weeds as well? Or do you, as the summer progresses, do you change the bait?
We throw a lot of bucktails here on Green Bay, so probably 90% of the time I'm throwing some type of a bucktail. Once in a while, we'll change and use some rubber-style baits. Like one of my favorites is called the Bulldog. So when the fish, like during cold fronts or if the fish move deeper, then we'll throw the rubber-style baits. And when they're in the weeds, I'm normally throwing bucktails when they're up in the weeds.
So let's turn to climate change for a moment. The state climatology office says this winter was the warmest on record for our state. How are warming temperatures affecting the muskies? You mentioned being ahead of schedule.
Yeah, it definitely put them into their spawning period a lot earlier this year than normal, which is actually good because once the fishing season opened this weekend, a lot of times people are targeting them in the areas where they're spawning. And I don't necessarily think that's a good thing. When the fish are spawning, I think they should be left alone, let them do their thing and reproduce. And then, I always wish that the season would open about a week or two later, just because of that fact that when they're in shallow spawning, they're easy to target and we're disrupting them when they're spawning.
And I was just looking at the DNR stocking records for last year, and it's like thousands of muskie when you combine DNR with private stocking. I'm just wondering, what is your assessment on the stocking effort?
Well, the stocking's been great for Green Bay. I mean, we've got more muskies in the system in the last 20 years than I've ever seen before. And we're also we had a huge cleanup project done on the lower part of Green Bay and the Fox River. And after that cleanup project, I'm seeing a lot of natural reproduction going on with the muskies. So when the fish are stocked on Green Bay and in the Fox River, they actually clip one of their pectoral fins. That's the lower fin on their belly. So you can tell when you catch a fish if it's a stock fish or it's if it's a natural fish. And I'm seeing a lot of the smaller fish now that are not fin clips. So I think we're getting a lot of natural reproduction the last few years on Green Bay.
Well, let me connect the dots here. You're saying a better environment, less water pollution, more spawning, and that's helping the fish thrive?
Yes. Yeah, we did a big cleanup project, or I should say the DNR headed it, but there's a huge cleanup project on the Fox River where it was basically the whole river, the bottom of the river was vacuumed out like 18 inches. Mm-hmm. They re-put sand and gravel on rock, and they also did a lot of restoration of habitat areas for juvenile fish, adding weeds and stuff like that. So I'm definitely seeing dividends now on that whole program.
We're checking in with Brett Alexander, who is a sport fishing guide in Green Bay. We're getting an assessment of the opening weekend of the muskie fishing season. Brett, how is fishing for muskie different from other species?
Well, first of all, you have to have a lot of patience because it's not a fish where you're going to go out and catch a lot of them every day. I always tell people, you know, if we can put, you know, two or three fish in the boat in an 8-hour day, that's a pretty good day of muskie fishing. So it's a lot of work, but it's one of the most exciting things that'll happen in a boat as far as fishing goes in freshwater, just because it's very explosive. It takes a lot of work to catch them. Muskies feed a lot on the moon phase. So you got to watch, you know, you got to know your lunar calendars and watch the different moon phases each day. And a lot of days you'll see them where all of a sudden they'll fire for a 10-15 minute period where they feed, you know, and it's all based on that lunar moon phase.
Wow. So that must be really exhilarating to see that really come together. And then just the catch itself, if it's that explosive.
Yeah, it definitely put goosebumps on your arms, that's for sure.
Well, the looking at the number of licenses for state fishing licenses, it's been down about 15% from a 2021 peak. How is a dip in overall fishing licenses affecting your business as a guide?
I have noticed, you know, when COVID hit, I mean, everybody was fishing. So I think that, you know, that was part of that peak that you saw. Now, you know, people are getting back to work. And so the numbers, you know, probably dropped a little bit because of that. A lot of people had time off work and they were enjoying the outdoors during those times. As far as for the number of trips that we're seeing, I have noticed, you know, a slight decline in the last like year and a half. I would say probably like a 10 to 15% decline from the couple of years prior to that. And I think the main factor is the economy and, you know, the whole COVID boost was where a lot of people were fishing and, you know, you had a lot of extra people buying licenses at that time.
Do you notice a younger generation fishing or coming up with an older adult or a grandparent? Do you see the next generation, you know, casting a line?
Yeah, I see a lot of, you know, I get a lot of customers that are bringing their kids, which is great to see. You know, it's definitely a great thing to see kids get involved in the outdoors and keep them out of trouble and keep them focused on something else.
How did you get into this sport? Who was it that you admired or went out fishing with?
My father was a huge outdoorsman, so I was fishing since I could walk, you know, ever since I can remember. I got pictures when I was 3 years old fishing, and I was just born with the fishing fever, and I've always loved to do it and had a huge passion for it.
So I wonder, for a sport fishing guide, when you have a day off, do you go out fishing somewhere?
Well, nowadays I normally don't have a day off. We're pretty busy. I've got myself and a few other guides that work with me, and so I don't get too many days off. But normally, if I do get a day off, I do not go fishing.
You're out on the water a lot as part of the work. You know, you were talking about the cleanup efforts in the Bay of Green Bay. What impact are invasive species like the silver carp and the big head carp, the white perch? What impact do those have on muskie fishing?
As far as muskie fishing, I think the main effect would be, say, like the carp issue. They can deplete food sources. I mean, you got to be careful of that. But muskies is pretty much your apex predator, and there's not much that is going to disturb them besides if something disturbs the food chain, you know, is eating the food that they eat. So you always want to be careful of that. An invasive species, it's something you definitely want to keep a good pulse on. You get the wrong invasive species in, and it can definitely be detrimental to a waterway for sure.
What about the invasive aquatic plants and blue-green algae? Has that been an issue at all?
Yeah, I haven't seen an issue on Green Bay, but mm-hmm. I've heard of other bodies of water where they have had some pretty major issues with that. Our main things on Green Bay that we've experienced were the zebra mussels. And I don't think the zebra mussels were actually that bad of a thing for Green Bay. It cleaned up our water a lot because zebra mussels filter.
Mm-hmm.
So our water got a lot cleaner because of them. The gobies were a big thing. Everybody was worried about the gobies. I think the gobies were actually a great thing for the Great Lakes because it provided a huge food source for walleye, smallmouth, whitefish, perch. Everything's eating the gobies. So, I think the gobies were a good thing. So you get the good with the bad.
And, you have to balance it out. Yeah. Well, Brett Alexander, we've entered lightning round. What piece of fishing gear do you always pack in your boat?
You always got to have a rod and reel is the main thing. So rod and reel and gas for the boat. So
you take it back to the basics. Well, it's been good to talk with you. I hope you have a really great season out there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Brett Alexander is a sport fishing guide based in Green Bay, and he joined us to discuss the opener of muskie fishing season in northern Wisconsin.
Coming up, a self-described underachiever from Oshkosh went on to form two of the biggest websites in political news. Jim Vandehei from Politico at Axios shares stories from his Wisconsin roots and inspiration for this year's high school and college graduates. That's up next here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Jim Vandehei says he was more interested in finishing a bottle of Jägermeister than in his college education when he attended UW Oshkosh in the 1990s.
Why it matters. Jim is now an experienced political journalist and successful entrepreneur. He co-founded the news websites Politico and Axios. He's also the CEO of Axios, where articles are set up with get-to-the-point phrases like why it matters and the bottom line.
The bottom line, his new book is called Just the Good Stuff, No BS Secrets to Success, No Matter What Life Throws at You. He delivered this year's commencement speech at UW Oshkosh. He's with us to share his Wisconsin roots and his advice for college and high school graduates. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
You were just recently back home to address this year's UW Oshkosh graduating class, and you told them, among other things, to be proud of where they're from. What makes you proud of being from Oshkosh and UW Oshkosh?
First off, I love everything about Wisconsin. I love going home. My parents are still there in Oshkosh. My brother, Johnny, and my sister, Julie, they're both in Oshkosh. They all live within about a mile of each other. I went to grade school, high school, college in Oshkosh, and I go back all the time. I'm a huge Packer fan, huge Brewer fan, huge Buck fan, so I'm pro-Wisconsin.
in that speech, you cited some of the professors who really inspired you and turned you on another path. And I think that's one of the themes from your book as well, finding out the right people to be inspired by. Talk a little bit about what you've learned over the years and what you're sharing in the new book.
Yeah, I mean, particularly as it relates to Wisconsin, I talked a lot to the students at the commencement address, and I address it in the book, just about the advantages of being from a small town and going to a smaller school. Not that UW is that small, but you just get this level of attention and individual kind of affection from your professors. You might not get at other schools. And I had one, Gene Hintz in journalism, this guy Jim Simmons in political science, who just saw things in me that I don't think I saw in myself back then, and really encouraged me to pursue journalism and pursue journalism by covering politics, hence the two, the double major that I had. And it made a profound difference in my life. And, you know, we grew up and didn't really leave the state that often. Like, we went to Florida one time for a vacation, we went to Mackinac Island, but for the most part, we went up to Three Lakes. So I spent almost all of my life only in Wisconsin. And, you know, looking back, just benefited tremendously from it. I was even telling my wife this morning, I just got back, I was there all weekend, and you go for a walk, and I had more people wave to me in one day, just because they're friendly, than I have in 20 years in Virginia. It's just a different place, and it's a special place, and I love it.
You were not, as you describe yourself, Jim, a rock star kind of student. You squeaked into UW Oshkosh after a couple of years at a two-year school. Your grade point your first year was sub 2.0. Set that scene for us a little bit before you started on the path you're on now.
Yeah, I guess charitably, I was a late bloomer. I was terrible in high school. I was a good partier, not necessarily good at academics. I graduated the bottom third of my high school class. I still vividly remember. I am scarred by going in to see my guidance counselor, and they hauled my parents in, and they said, there's no way this kid's going to college. I still went to a two-year college to get into UW Oshkosh, where I still struggled until I found what I wanted to do, which is I found journalism, I found political science, really matched kind of, I think, the skill set that I had, the interests that I had, and things took off in a much more positive direction from that. But a big part of writing the book, and a reason I was really excited to go back and do the commencement address, is I think there's a lot of people out there who have a similar life trajectory, and you kind of think, well, I didn't get that great of grades, or I didn't come from privilege or money, therefore I can't go be a surgeon, or I can't go to New York and work on Wall Street, or go to DC and work in politics. And my message is, like, you sure as hell can. Like, there's nothing that's holding you back. And if you find something that you want to do, you're super passionate about it, you do the hard work, and there is a lot of hard work if you want to be successful at anything. And I don't sugarcoat that. I work my tail off to do the things that I've done. But that's all very possible. And if that inspires, you know, one kid in Ripon, Wisconsin, or, you know, Manitowoc, to say, okay, I'm going to go do something I might not have otherwise done and had kind of the courage to do it, that would be cool.
I knew about your journalistic career at the Washington Post, and then a Politico and Axios. I didn't know about your stint with the Brilliant News here in Wisconsin till I read Just the Good Stuff. Tell us a little bit about what that summer meant for you.
It was everything. So Brilliant Wisconsin, small community, basically sandwiched in between Oshkosh and Green Bay. And I had a real interest in journalism and thought I was going to be a sports journalist. And then I was like, I really like the news in general. So I picked up a list of every newspaper in the state of Wisconsin. It was alphabetical. And I just started calling it because I had a summer where I would have interned for free. And one of the first places I called was at Brilliant News. And this guy, Zane Zander, who recently passed away, he picked up the phone and he said, could you come here today? And I said, sure, yeah, I'll drive up there. And I really hadn't taken any journalism classes. I had covered sports a little bit at the Oshkosh Northwestern. And I go up there and I explain this to him, and he just cuts me off. He says, yeah, will you run my newspaper? And I'm like, I don't think I'm the guy who should be running your newspaper. I haven't done anything. He's like, well, I have an issue. My editor's going to leave and for 3 months to go to Finland. And if I don't find someone to run it for those 3 months, he's never coming back. And so if you do this in 1 week, I will teach you how to do everything from the writing to the photography to the layout to understanding agriculture community, like, you name it. And he was true to his word. I would work 80, 100 hours a week. And he gave me the best pay package, the best pay package you could get if you're, you know, 19 or 20 year old living in Wisconsin who didn't have any money. He offered me, I think it was $300 a week. He gave me a new rental car that I could use for the summer, and he let me stay in his cottage, which was on a little pond full of largemouth bass. And part of my pay package was the refrigerator would always be loaded with beer. And I thought I had hit the jackpot, and that really got me hooked. And I, you know, screwed up a lot of stuff early on, but then learned a lot and really was on fire for journalism after that. And again, like, that doesn't happen everywhere. That was a magic of like somebody believing that hard work and, you know, a good person could probably put those two things together and do things.
And Jim, that ties into another, I think, theme of a lot of the advice chapters in your book. You talk about, you know, you can't completely make your own luck, but you can in the sense that when you get that opportunity, like you did at the Brilliant News, making sure you get the most you can out of it.
Yeah, you know, you hear it a lot about positioning yourself for luck, which is, yes, like I could point to a bunch of breaks that gave me career success. But I will say in my own defense, like I was taking those chances. I was making those calls. I was doing the internships, right? You got to put yourself in places to benefit from luck. If you just sit in the house and you're just scrolling through Instagram, you're probably not going to get lucky. But if you're picking up the phone, you're talking to people, you're asking people for advice, you're volunteering to be the first person in the office, the last person to leave, that's what stands out. And I've certainly benefited from that. I had good work ethic. I had a curious mind. And, you know, maybe I was too dumb to feel like I was going to fail. And there's some mix of that put me in a really nice position to, you know, ultimately move out to D.C. And that's where my career took off. You know, even when I moved to D.C., I sent out 100-120 resumes. And the only job I got was carrying bricks for a bricklayer for 6 months until I got a job in journalism. So it's not, success doesn't come to anyone instantaneously, but I kind of like carrying bricks. Like I've always liked almost everything I've ever done. I loved delivering pizzas at Little Caesars and Red's Pizza in Oshkosh when I did it. But once I moved out to D.C., got into journalism, got a job, it was just such a natural fit. I love to write. I love to think. I love to be curious. I love to be mischievous. And like journalism was the perfect place for it.
Jim Vandehei is with us sharing life lessons, including from his time, his growing up here in Wisconsin. Jim is co-founder and CEO of the news website Axios. His new book of advice is called Just the Good Stuff. What led you, Jim, to tackle advice for the next generation, chapter by chapter in your new book?
Yeah, you know, I write in the beginning, it takes a lot of hubris to say you know enough to go give people advice on how to handle things. The reason that I wrote the book, though, was I was in this unique position where, okay, I became a journalist. I worked for the Wall Street Journal. I worked for the Washington Post. I covered presidents. We started, a group of us started Politico. We started Axios. And I was CEO of both companies and still am CEO of Axios. And so I was in this rare position where I was a journalist who happened to become an entrepreneur, who happened to become a CEO. So I've seen every level of management and leadership. And I took really close notes. And I'm pretty honest about myself. And so like there's a ton of stuff in learning all these things that I screwed up that I wish someone had told me, hey, do it this way. And that's what the purpose of the book is, to say, listen, if you're graduating college, you're entering the workforce, you want to be a manager, you want to be a CEO, you want to be a better CEO, I think there's a ton of advice in there that comes from a really honest place of me screwing it up the first time, but then watching people in positions of extraordinary power who do it well and trying to build that into my own repertoire. So hopefully anybody walks away from the book, they walk away with 10, 15, 20 different tricks that help them be better at work and be happier at work.
One bit of advice I loved, we talked a little bit about people who'd inspired you, Jim. You also say watch for the people in your workplace who are terrible or toxic or bad in some way, figure out what makes them that way, and then do the opposite. How do we do that?
I think a big part of it is being open-eyed, right? Like watching what other people do. Don't be so self-indulgent that you're not paying attention to the people around the table. And I would say when you start to pay attention, you see the attributes in people that are magnetic, right? You want to be around people who are optimistic. You want to be around people who are hardworking. You want to be around people who are doing the right thing for the right reason. The flip side of that is when you see people who are talking behind other people's back, or they're being deceitful, or they're cutting corners, or they're trying to knock someone off so they can get ahead. It's repulsive. And when you see that and you're repulsed by it, you should know that's not the type of person that you want to be. You never want to have any of those attributes. And so I've probably learned as much about leadership and management and even myself by watching people who I thought had bad values and bad actions and just tried to do the opposite of it. But it does require just paying a lot more attention. I talk in the book a lot about, I think one of the reasons I had success is I was a pretty good poker player when I was younger, and part of playing poker, and one of the reasons I've encouraged my children to play a lot of poker, is it forces you to interact with different people from different lots of life. It forces you to read other people around a table. It forces you to be able to control your own impulses. And I think attributes like that help you just better understand people. In some ways, it's a way to teach yourself emotional intelligence, reading people and reading between the lines.
You also talk about health, self-improvement in the book. And here you say your Wisconsin upbringing might get in your way. You give a detailed list of, you know, potatoes soaked with butter and sour cream, smothered with cheese, and fresh fish bathed in flour, bread dropped in boiling oil, and so on. How much of a fight is you to stay healthy versus the food you grew up eating here in the state?
It's funny because every time I go home, my mom still serves the potatoes with the cornflakes, the cheese, and the sour cream. I'm like, Mom, a potato is actually pretty good in and of its own. Yeah, I try not to be too preachy in the book, but one thing I found for myself is, like, I'm only really good at work, or even really good as a husband and a father, is if I'm feeling good about myself. And one of the things that's been a massive difference maker for me in my own life is just being very conscious about being healthy, about what am I putting into my body, but also exercising and vigorously and in different ways just to stay active. I have this weird spinal disorder that could become a real problematic, and I became obsessed with whatever. I'm going to try to be as fit as I can so I can, like, be as productive as I can for as long as I can. And so far, so good. And to me, it's not about here, go follow this diet or go run 8 miles. It's much more think about you and think about what are the things that you do that make you feel good about yourself and make you perform better. And what are the things you do that, if you're being honest with yourself, make you feel like crap. And try to stop doing the things that make you feel like crap and try to do the things that make you feel better about yourself. It sounds so simple, but I don't think most people do that type of personal inventory. And when you do it, it's not self-indulgent or selfish to do that. I think it's beneficial. You're just going to be a better friend, a better neighbor.
Speaking of self-indulgence, Jim, in that address at UW Oshkosh and in your book, you talk about the need to not just focus on the benefits to yourself and improving yourself and your career outlook, but keeping in mind other people and serving other people. Why do you want to see that front and center?
I think we all know it. I think we feel it even when we're young, when we go help maybe an elderly neighbor, you know, shovel their driveway, or we volunteer for something. You feel good about it. You feel better than if you did something for yourself. And the more I've been embedded in companies, the more I believe this to be true. Like, I get the most satisfaction and joy from being able to help someone else do something they didn't think that they could do. Or, you know, with our company, we talk all the time about we're trying to get people smarter, faster on what matters. That's what Axios does. And there's like a higher purpose to that. It's not just about us making money. And obviously we're a for-profit company in capitalism, so we want to make money and we want it to be durable. But there's something bigger than that, and when you play to something bigger than that, you just feel better about yourself. And I, you know, like, life throws enough at us. Like, bad things happen. I'm 53, so I could give you my list. You could give me yours of friends and family who are suffering in ways that seem patently unfair. And so, the more you can surround yourself with good feeling and good people and good deeds, I think the more fortified you're going to be for those really difficult moments, which stack up the older we get.
Since we're talking during graduation season, Jim, and you hire young journalists, you have over the years, wanted to get your thoughts on kids these days. And from where I'm sitting, I'm on hiring committees sometimes, 20-somethings come in, and they're amazing. If I had 20-something me had been up against them for a job, I'd be unemployed, I think. What is your take on this rising generation?
Yeah, I'm more in your camp, right? I think there's a lot of people that roll their eyes at this new generation. They feel like it's entitled and they all want to be CEO by the time they're 24. I just chalk that up to be healthy ambition. I think what I see coming into the workforce is people who, like you said, are just, they know technology. They're so fluent in culture in ways that we never were. And they are, but they're motivated differently. So when I got into the workforce, probably when you got into the workforce, we wanted a paycheck and we didn't want someone to hit us. Now they want a lot more than that, buddy, right? They want meaning. They want purpose. They want to feel like the work that they're doing is making them better and somehow is making society better. And I think they're right and we were wrong. I think it's great if the amount of time that we spend at work, why not doing something that makes you feel good about yourself and feel like the company you work for stands for things that give you a smile on your face? And so it just means you manage them differently. So I spend probably a lot less time talking about how much money you're going to make and much more time talking about the good that we're doing or the environment that I'm creating. So you can be a high achiever, but you can do it in a place that you feel is safe and you feel like it's dynamic and you feel it's respectful. And that's all anybody ultimately wants. You know, what I flip side, what I tell younger workers is there's something you can learn from our generation, which is you do have to work hard. Like there is a direct correlation between effort and output. And that doesn't mean you have to work 100 hours a week, but it does mean when you're working, work hard. There's nothing to be ashamed about that. And that ultimately it is a job. Like you have to rely on family and friends and your church and other things for a level of meaning that most companies just aren't going to be able to provide for you. So I spend a lot of time basically trying to merge my generation with the new generation. And I think the hybrid of the two is really cool. I think the work environment now is way better than it was when I was younger. I think we talk about topics more forthrightly. And I think the amount of transparency that younger people expect is great. I think they want too much transparency, but that's okay. They just want to know what's going on and why it's going on.
Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
I appreciate it. Take care. Go Packers.
Jim VandeHei is co-founder and CEO of the news website Axios and a graduate of his hometown school, UW Oshkosh. We talked to him today about life advice he shares in his new book. It's called Just the Good Stuff, No BS Secrets to Success, No Matter What Life Throws at You.
Coming up, a museum exhibit in Milwaukee tells the story of environment and inequality and hope and resilience in North Milwaukee neighborhoods. We explore the stories behind the Climates of Inequality exhibition coming up on Wisconsin Today.
Wisconsin Today, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For residents of Milwaukee's North Side, their local environment has been shaped in large part by unequal city investment and policies, and that's had an impact on the quality of life in the area, from rundown buildings to segregation to unequal access to fresh food.
A new exhibit at the Milwaukee Historical Society shares that history, the stories of people who live in the community, and their solutions to these problems.
Over the last 5 years, students from UW-Milwaukee's Buildings, Landscapes, Cultures, Public History Field School, they've been collecting those stories from the exhibit. It's called Climates of Inequality, Stories of Environmental Justice, and it runs through the end of this month.
I recently talked to three of the people involved in putting together the exhibit for a look at the historical background and some solutions coming from the community. Camille Mays is a resident of the Sherman Park neighborhood in Milwaukee and founder of the Peace Garden Project. Reggie Jackson is board chairman of the Dr. James Cameron Legacy Foundation, the parent organization of America's Black Holocaust Museum. Reggie is also the museum's head griot, or docent. And Tiana Cooksey grew up in the north side of Milwaukee and graduated from UW-Milwaukee, where she was part of the Public History Field School. She's doing research on Milwaukee after getting a master's degree from Columbia University in New York. Tiana, let's start with you. Can you talk a little bit about the research that you're doing that's contributing to this Climates of Inequality project?
So in 2016, I started working with Arijit Sen in his Building Landscapes Field School. And through that research, we looked into two different neighborhoods, the Washington Park neighborhood and the Sherman Park neighborhood. And from that research process, I created my own project, which was the Women's Empowerment Network, which essentially looks at foreclosure and eviction and how it affects Black women in Milwaukee, and looking at how to use design and planning techniques to create a housing typology and to merge different strategic partnerships to create resources and utilize a housing stock that is currently vacant in Milwaukee.
And we'll dig into some of your suggestions in a bit. Camille, let's bring you in now. You've been part of this this project, of this research, of this community for years as well. What has it meant to you to work with students from UW-Milwaukee and community members on sharing stories from where you live?
It's really nice to put together community university and get the stories out. The university allowed the community members to reach things like renderings and writing up really good plans, getting their stories out of how they envisioned the neighborhood and reimagined the spaces in the neighborhood and come up with very creative, innovative ways to look at future plans. I think some of the plans we even came with should be included in city plans. So it was really good for people to actually have a space where their voices could be heard and on display.
Reggie, a lot of this is focused on what we're going to do in the future. Can you tell us a little bit about the past, some historical context on Milwaukee's North Side neighborhoods that really form the heart of this story?
Yeah, so Milwaukee is, considered to be one of the most segregated communities in the country. And basically, where we are today is the majority of the people that live on the north side of Milwaukee are African Americans. And so the African American community in Milwaukee was very, very small in the 1930s and 1940s, but it was a thriving community. And as the factories and unions started to open up to allow African American workers to join the workforce in Milwaukee, the African American population grew very rapidly from about 9,000 in 1940 to over 62,000 by 1960 and over 105,000 by 1970. So, very rapid rise. And those were people that were coming to Milwaukee in the latter stages of the Great Migration out of the South, as African Americans were leaving the South to go to a place they thought would be better for them. And the primary driver of that was, good, high quality manufacturing and government related jobs in Milwaukee. And so it was a place that allowed African Americans to thrive for a number of years. Unfortunately, those jobs started to go away in the 1970s and 1980s and completely reversed the fortunes of people that came to Milwaukee for a better situation. And along with the jobs going away, we also started to see some disinvestment within the city limits. City and county government really disinvested in the north side of Milwaukee, really didn't put a lot of money into keeping the conditions, the same on the north side as they did on the south side and the east side of the city of Milwaukee. And we've seen a lot of deterioration in the infrastructure on the north side. And so, African Americans are dealing with a situation in terms of the climate of where they live, which is something that they didn't create. They just simply been the victims of it. Of this disinvestment and the loss of really high quality jobs that were replaced by service sector, low paying jobs. And it's really just kind of a really sad situation because we have a lot of really good people in the community that work hard every day. And yet, we don't hear those positive stories. That was part of what, was really impactful about this project for me was to meet people from the community and hear how resilient people are despite all of these things that have happened. And the fact that people were finally listening to their voices for the first time in their lives. And people are really, really smart. They know about the problems that they face, and they have typically better solutions to those problems than policymakers who are elected officials and other people. If only people would listen to them, I think we could make a lot more progress.
Tiana, part of that story Reggie just told was literally the building stock in North Side neighborhoods. And that's part of what your research is looking at. What kind of really concrete, literally changes would you like to see? What would match with some of those community hopes that Reggie was talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that right now, especially in Milwaukee, what I noticed after moving to New York particularly is that a lot of the housing stock is just not being utilized. And I think that when you propose designs that could work and mitigate a lot of the challenges that are based on what people actually want and how people actually live, that could work. But I think it also needs to be paired with some type of economic strategy. So I've been looking a lot at like economic models that could be utilized to, for instance, separate the price of land and buildings so that you could purchase one thing and have equity growing. Because one thing that happens is once you start to invest, the neighborhood starts to increase value. So sometimes it becomes harder for people to stay in place. And I think that's one thing that we need to think about too, is how do you get what you want and maintain the positionality of it while still increasing value?
And Camille, you and Reggie have both mentioned the importance of, you know, not coming up with just solutions from on high or the outside. What kind of things came out of talking to people in the community about their hopes, their dreams, and the ways they want to get there?
So one thing I've noted, when neighborhoods do get upgrades, if you look at the Harambe neighborhood has been getting multiple upgrades, new businesses along 3rd Street, stores. And in a result of that, a lot of the people who did have housing equity in those neighborhoods had tax issues. They faced being pushed out of their homes because of that. So one, I think that we need to find something that protects elders and older and long-term homeowners when the neighborhoods do get upgrades, with being able to maintain and keep the homes that they do own, for one. And then the second thing that I need, or that I think needs to actually take place, is that people have to look at the home buying with the housing stock, right? We have city programs that have things for first-time home buyers, right? And people always point to those programs. But what you see happening a lot, it's almost like a money pit situation, right? Because they'll give them some funding to get into the house. So they had the payments on the house going. And then they'll give them like a grant or something to fix up the home. However, the scope of work will be way beyond what the loan amount is. So you take the mortgage, the grant that they get or the assistance, but then they still have out-of-pocket expenses with, you know, getting the house up to par. So what I think needs to happen is, before they allow like the first-time homeowners program, I think some of these house and properties should be fixed up. And then also, a lot of what we see or what people have been complaining about is people from out of town. The amount of slumlords or out-of-town homeowners who own or who are buying up multiple properties in Milwaukee, I think to provide some type of equity to Milwaukee residents, it should be some type of incentive for Milwaukee buyers to be able to buy, like these out-of-town people.
Reggie, what Camille just said, all those examples point to how difficult it can be to solve some of these problems. Even in her first case, if you're successful and you bring in stores, you bring up the quality of life, well, you might bring up property values and people who live there can't afford to live there anymore. Can you talk about how sometimes success doesn't stick around or it leads to unexpected consequences?
Yeah, absolutely. Those are brilliant points by Camille. You know, when I think about the point she made about older residents who have been long-term homeowners, you know, they're dealing with some pretty significant increases in their property taxes. And there is a program in place, this anti-displacement fund, but it's very limited. It only covers a very small couple communities in the city. In addition to that, I think another important factor is people have to understand that the housing stock on the north side of the city is the oldest housing stock in the city of Milwaukee. And, you know, there's a lot of conversations the last few years about corporate landlords buying property, as Camille talked about. But what people don't realize is that there are a lot of other people that aren't these corporations, these private equity firms that have been buying up properties in the city of Milwaukee, because Milwaukee is a very attractive place for people who want to be landlords. houses are very cheap for the most part as compared to peer cities, and rents are significantly higher than they should be, I think. But you also have people throughout the state of Wisconsin that are homeowners, that are landlords, and you have a lot of people from out of state in the last, probably during the pandemic, particularly when the interest rates are really low, you start to see a lot of private equity firms really begin to buy just thousands and thousands of homes in Milwaukee. And they tend to be very bad landlords. They don't keep up with the maintenance as well as other landlords do. And in addition to that, they are much quicker to evict people. You know, there are a lot of other cities that are dealing with that same problem. And some cities have actually put a cap on the number of properties that these private equity firms are able to purchase in their communities. Our city government has really not even had much of a conversation about doing anything about these corporate landlords, as far as I've heard.
We're talking about the Climates of Inequality, Stories of Environmental Justice exhibition at the Milwaukee Historical Society, focusing on Northside Milwaukee, with community member Camille Mays, researcher Tiana Cooksey, and Reggie Jackson with the Dr. James Cameron Legacy Foundation. Tiana, what is it like for you as someone who grew up in this community, went away, and now you're coming back to do research there?
Yes. Ever since I was young, I used to go to school on the east side, so a lot of times I would bus across the city and see how the city changed, either through a business district, some parks, or some highways. And that is pretty much what prompted me to be interested in architecture and planning combined. So I did my undergraduate at UWM, and then I just went to grad school for a master's of architecture and planning at Columbia. And all of my work through both programs was really focused on this idea that started in Milwaukee with the Women's Empowerment Network idea. And so my capstone is literally looking at, in New York, for instance, how have people basically been able to create resistance to gentrification, especially because the cost of living is so high. So I really started to look into successful precedents in New York and in Brooklyn in particular, but also understanding how, if you do, for instance, brownfield remediation, which a lot of people can access funding through that, how the neighborhood will change in 20 years because of that, and how steering committees are extremely important because they can influence policy and they can create those boundaries or restrictions to what gets developed. And so I think that really understanding from all of the people I talk to, the entire process of development and everything that goes into it creates a better positionality for you to be able to say exactly what you want and know how to get it. And I think that the biggest thing that came up was financing. And I want to see what that looks like in Milwaukee because it is so much easier to access housing stock or land in Milwaukee. And I think that if people really knew how much potential Milwaukee had, it would be extremely important to get the right stakeholders together so that maybe we can collectively purchase property and be able to influence policy to stand against the big businesses that are able to do that more easily. So I think for me, growing up in Milwaukee, I've always been interested in how can I not only influence the way that the city changes, but also be a part in leading in that change. And I think that all of the work done in the Climates of Inequality, the Buildings, Landscapes, Field School has taught me like the base mechanisms or methods to be able to go about the work. And now is really more exploratory right now to see like what is actually feasible, what can I actually do, and what resources do I have to tap into.
We've been talking about the Climates of Inequality, Stories of Environmental Justice exhibition showing through the end of this month at the Milwaukee Historical Society, focused on the past, present, and future of Northside Milwaukee. I recently talked to community member Camille Mays, researcher Tiana Cooksey, and Reggie Jackson with the Dr. James Cameron Legacy Foundation.
Kate, have you ever been out big tree hunting in your spare time?
Well, I have not, but I do love to look up and admire this magnificent Scotch pine that is in my yard.
We're going to be talking to Wisconsin big tree hunters on the show. They've made looking for big trees into this competitive international hobby.
And we want to hear from you if you are a big tree hunter yourself, or if you have a favorite forest, maybe even a favorite tree in your yard. Tell us about it. Leave us a message right now at 888-642-0232. You can also find that number at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today, where you can email and text us as well.
Kate, you know me. I would never tell a corny joke at the expense of trees, but it's no joke. We really do want to hear from you at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.